on the first day of the second month of the second year after the Israelites came out of Egypt. He said, take a census of the whole Israelite community by their clans and families, listing every man by name, one by one. You and Aaron are to number by their divisions all men in Israel, 20 years old or more, who are able to serve in the army. One man from each tribe, each the head of his family, is to help you. And these are the names of the men who are to assist you. And so here you have then the actual list, the names, the details, the descendants of each tribe, from Reuben, Simeon, Gad, Judah, Issachar, so on. And let's come to verse 44. These were the men counted by Moses and Aaron and the 12 leaders of Israel, each one representing his family. All the Israelites 20 years old or more who were able to serve in Israel's army were counted according to their families. The total number was 603,550. Now, the family of the tribe of Levi, however, were not counted along with the others because God gave to them the charge of the tabernacle. They had to set it up and take it down whenever the Israelites moved and the priests came out of the tribe of Levi. So you have this census taken, and that is why the book is called Numbers. And it's interesting to see that they have at least 600,000 fighting men by this time. And when they were first in Israel, there were 70, in Egypt, there were 70 people that came to Egypt in the family of Jacob. Let's consider now, 3a, the general content of the book. What is happening here? We are at the Mount Sinai, where they have been given the law. And they have been given the tabernacle worship. And they have been given the priesthood. Aaron and his sons have been anointed as the priests. They have God's presence with them. And let's read about that in chapter 9 and about verse 15. In chapter 9 and about verse 15, where we read about how God is going to be with them, lead them and guide them. 9:15. On the day the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony, was set up, the cloud covered it. And that is the cloud of glory, the Lord's presence. From evening till morning, the cloud above the tabernacle looked like fire. That is how it continued to be. The cloud covered it, and at night it looked like fire. Whenever the cloud lifted from above the tent, the Israelites set out. Wherever the cloud settled, the Israelites encamped. At the Lord's command, the Israelites set out. At His command, they encamped. As long as the cloud stayed over the tabernacle, they remained in the camp. When the cloud remained over the tabernacle a long time, the Israelites obeyed the Lord's order and did not set out. Sometimes the cloud was over the tabernacle only a few days. At the Lord's command, they would encamp, and at His command, they would set out. Sometimes the cloud stayed only from evening till morning, and when it lifted in the morning, they set out. Whether by day or night, whenever the cloud lifted, they set out. Whether the cloud stayed over the tabernacle 2 days or a month or a year, the Israelites would remain in camp and not set out, but when it lifted, they would set out. At the Lord's command, they encamped. At the Lord's command, they set out. They obeyed the Lord's order in accordance with His command through Moses. God is there. And He's leading and guiding His people. And they have this going on. They have the law, they have the tabernacle, they have the priesthood, they have God's presence. And now they have an orderly community. Let's read about that in chapter 2. An orderly way to do this. Chapter 2, verse 1. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, the Israelites are to camp around the tent of meeting some distance from it, each man under his standard with the banners of his family. On the east toward the sunrise, the divisions of the camp of Judah are to encamp under their standard, and so on. In verse 10, you read about those who will be on the south. Verse 17, then the tent of meeting, the tabernacle, and the camp of the Levites will set out in the middle of the camps. They will set out in the same order as they encamp, each in his own place under his standard. Verse 18, on the west. Verse 25, on the north. And so, verse 34, the Israelites did everything the Lord commanded Moses. That is the way they encamped under their standards, and that is the way they set out, each with his clan and his family. Now you have also there a map and a picture of, it's not greatly clear, but gives some idea of how they did this. The tabernacle in the center, and the orderly arrangements of three tribes, north, south, east, and west, on around the tabernacle. And each tribe in its place, and each clan in that tribe in its place, each family in its place, each man in his place, God set out an orderly community. And this is a marvelous thing to see. Now, if there are 600,000 fighting men, and there are four people to a family, there's 2 million or more people here. Now, if every fourth person has a tent, you have 500,000 tents. Isn't that amazing what was happening here? 500,000 or so tents to set up. Now that takes some doing. I want to talk about that a little later. Now then, the Lord gives them command, and they set out, and they begin to go toward Kadesh. You have your map there, and we'll be looking at that a little bit. And they do get over to a place on your map near the wilderness of Zin called Kadesh Barnea. And there they camp, and that's where they send out the spies. And Joseph and Caleb said, let's go in and take the land. And the other 10 spies said, no, we can't do it. So there is a decision to go back. And then they wander some more. And there are 40 years there where they wander around Kadesh Barnea in the wilderness of Zin. And this is the children of Israel, this family of Abraham, which has become around 2 million people, wandering around in the desert for 40 years, when, at least from a human viewpoint, they could have gone into the land with a very short journey from Kadesh Barnea. God had promised to give it to them, but they did not. Now, as you know, as I think of this, I'm just overwhelmed and amazed at what God could do here in terms of logistics. Could you take 2 million people across this desert? Can you do that? Now, could Moses do that? No, Moses said, Lord, I can't do it. This is too much for me. Can Aaron do it? He says, no. Could Joshua? No. How are you going to get 2 million people camped and then journeying across this desert? That is a huge, gigantic task. God did it. Now, you just boil this down and think about yourself when you take a trip, and the logistics involved in getting ready. Now, a few times we have gone with our gang to Joshua Tree, where they four-wheel. And that takes some doing. I mean, they got to load the trucks, and they've got to take their own water and plan the food for that weekend and firewood and gasoline and just a whole bunch of stuff to plan and take out there. And then we run short at times. So that's a big thing, and that's only about 20 people. Well, if you've got 2 million, how are you going to do all that? But even more amazing is when Faye and I go for a weekend. That takes some doing. I mean, you would think we were going to spend a year in India. That's one of the reasons I bought a red truck. No. I mean, our medicine chest alone takes some doing. Vitamins. We have vitamins galore. And Pepto-Bismol is always necessary. K-O-Pectate. Everything is prepared. I mean, we're not missing a thing, and we're going. Takes some doing. Takes a while. 2 million people across a desert, no food, no water, no way to acquire new clothing or new shoes. You think about this. Read the book of Numbers and see what God did just in that regard. Now, while they're wandering around, there's a lot of complaining and a lot of rebellion. It's not just the logistics. How does God get these stubborn, stiff-necked people, he calls them, into that promised land? Can he do it? Well, listen to some of the complaining. Chapter 11. Now, he's taken them out of Egypt. He's taken care of them so far. He's defeated some of the enemies. They're all right so far. But now in chapter 11, verse 1, they're still going at it. Now the people complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord, and when he heard them, his anger was aroused. Then fire from the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. When the people cried out to Moses, he prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down, so that place was called Taberah, because fire from the Lord had burned among them. The rabble with them began to crave other food. Now, when they went out from Egypt, it was not only the family of Jacob that went out, but they took others with them, some Egyptians who were not accustomed to the ways of the Lord. A mixed multitude went with them, and they're troublemakers. And along with the Israelites, they began to crave other food. And again, the Israelites started wailing and said, "If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we've lost our appetite. And we never see anything but this manna." Well, what a thing to complain about. Who cares if you don't have leeks in your salad or onions? Well, broccoli, maybe. I mean, maybe you would have said something about that, or avocados, but, you know, you could live without garlic. But here they are complaining. Verse 7, "The manna was like coriander seed, looked like rosin. The people went around gathering it, ground it into a handmill or crushed it in a mortar. They cooked it in a pot or made it into cakes. Tasted like something made with olive oil. When the dew settled on the camp at night, the manna also came down." And so that was a sustaining food that God was supplying for them. And so then Moses hears the complaint of the people, and they're crying out for meat and so on. Verse 18, tell the people, consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow when you will eat meat. The Lord heard you when you wailed, if only we had meat to eat, we were better off in Egypt. Now the Lord will give you meat, and you will eat it. You will not eat of it just for one day or 2 days or 5 or 10 or 20, but for a whole month until it comes out your nostrils and you loathe it, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you, and you wailed before him saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? Verse 31. Now a wind went out from the Lord and drove quail in from the sea. It brought them down all around the camp to about 3 feet above the ground, as far as a day's walk in any direction. All that day and night and all the next day, the people went out and gathered quail. No one gathered less than several bushels, and they spread them out all around the camp. But while the meat was still between their teeth and before it could be consumed, the anger of the Lord burned against them, and he struck them with a severe plague. You want meat? That's what you got. You want to complain? You'll pay for it. So there's the wandering here. Not a good record for most of the people, especially at Kadesh Barnea. Now, we have the intercession of Moses in chapter 14. After the people had rejected the idea of going into the promised land, the Lord was in a conversational way making a bargain with Moses, which is just conversation and not an intention. Verse 10, chapter 14, verse 10. The whole assembly talked about stoning them, that is, Joshua and Caleb, after they gave the good report. Then the glory of the Lord appeared at the tabernacle to all the Israelites. The Lord said to Moses, how long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me in spite of all the miraculous signs I have performed among them? I will strike them down with the plague and destroy them, but I will make you into a nation greater and stronger than they. Now, this is a pretty hard thing to put on men. I'll destroy these complainers, Moses, but I'll set you up and you'll have a kingdom and an empire for yourself and you'll be great. You'll be top one. That's difficult for a human being to refuse. Verse 13, Moses said to the Lord, then the Egyptians will hear about it. By your power you brought these people up from among them, and they will tell the inhabitants of this land about it. They have already heard that you, O Lord, are with these people, and you, O Lord, have been seen face to face, that your cloud stays over them, that you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. If you put these people to death all at one time, the nations who have heard this report about you will say, the Lord was not able to bring these people into the land he promised them on oath, so he slaughtered them in the desert. Now may the Lord's strength be displayed just as you have declared. The Lord is slow to anger, abounding in love and forgiving sin and rebellion, yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation. In accordance with your great love, forgive the sin of these people, just as you have pardoned them from the time they left Egypt and until now. And the Lord replied, I have forgiven them as you asked. What marvelous intercession. To come before God and plead for a people. How we need to learn intercessory prayer. We get so accustomed to giving in to Satan and giving in to sin that we forget to plead with God. And here Moses stands as the intercessor before God for these people. If there's a burden on your heart, never give up. Keep on praying. Keep on interceding. Our Lord Jesus Christ this morning is our intercessor. He's standing there in the presence of God as our defense attorney. Moses, the most humble man on earth, stands here in intercession. And God said, I have forgiven them as you asked. However, none of that generation is going to get into the land. Now then, later on, Moses sins in chapter 20, verse 10. It's interesting in the Bible that the true record is there, that the failure of mankind is not hidden, and the failure of great leaders is not hidden, but their sin is also recorded. Now, in chapter 20, there is the people begin to complain again because they had no water. Let's pick it up in verse 2, chapter 20. Now there was no water for the people, and they gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. They quarreled with Moses and said, if only we had died where our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's people into this desert that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grain or figs, grapevines or pomegranates. There's no water to drink. Moses and Aaron went from the assembly to the entrance to the tent of the meeting and fell face down. And the glory of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord said to Moses, take the staff, and you, your brother Aaron, gather the assembly together. Speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You will bring water out of the rock for the community, so they and their livestock can drink. So Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he had commanded him. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock? Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff, and the water rushed out, and the community and the livestock drank. But there's a problem. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring these people into the land I give them. God simply said to Moses, speak to the rock. That's all you need. Just speak to the rock. I'll bring out the water. But Moses is going to go in his own way and exhibit his temper tantrum in his impatience with the people at this point, and he hits the rock twice. That was disobedience. Taking up his own methods, his own style, doing it his own way. And that's pretty much how we get to operating in the church. We think God is slow. We think His methods won't work because we lived in this fast-paced 20th century yuppie life. And we've got to figure out all kinds of new methods and new styles to do things. Let's just be careful. When God says it's this way, we need to listen. So we have the wanderings of the people. 3b then, it's on to the promised land. The original generation of these people has died, and now God is going to take them in. And he brings them back to the place of Kadesh Barnea. And then he's going to take them up. If you look on your map, he's going to take them on up to camp in the plains of Moab opposite Jericho. And Moses is going to die, and God's going to raise up Joshua, and they're going into the land. Now, the message. What is the message of the book? We've considered the content. What is the message? The message of the book of Numbers is about the faithfulness of God. Now, I know the popular approach to this book is to dwell on chapters 13 and 14 and play up the sin and failure and unbelief of the people in not going into that land right at that point. And we dwell on that. But that is not the main message of this book. The main message of this book goes far beyond that to the faithfulness of God, who did get the people in the land. And He did that in spite of the sin and failure and unbelief of that generation. See, it was God's original intent, this promise to Abraham. I'm going to give you a big family, a great family, and I'm going to give you a land. And God did it. And in spite of the failure of the people, God did it anyway. And if you wanted to write a name for this book, along with the name numbers, you might put, God did it anyway. That's the message. The faithfulness of God. Now, those 40 years of wandering have the purpose of teaching them to trust Him. And during those days of wandering, they learn many things about trusting God. Now, let's consider this experience at Kadesh Barnea, though, back to chapters 13 and 14. What is happening there? What actually happens? We won't dwell long on that, but we need to see what's happening. Numbers 13, verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, "Send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving." You want to underline that. Said, "Send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. From each tribe send one of its leaders to spy out the land." And they give the names of the men, one from each tribe, and their experience there. And Moses tells them what to look for about the soil and the people. Verse 21, "So they went up, explored the land from the desert of Zin as far as Rehob to Lebo Hamath. They came up through the Negev to Hebron and all these places. Verse 23, "When they reached the valley of Eshcol, they cut off a branch carrying a single cluster of grapes. Two of them carried it on a pole between them along with some pomegranates and figs. That place was called the valley of Eshcol because the cluster of grapes the Israelites cut off was there. At the end of 40 days, they returned from exploring the land." Now, can't you see? Two fellas, a bunch of grapes, big enough that two men had to carry it. Why, even Texas doesn't have them that big. And here they're in that land. Verse 26, "They came back to Moses and Aaron, the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the desert of Paran. There they reported to them and the whole assembly and showed the fruit of the land." They gave Moses this account. "We went into the land which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey, and here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. And we saw the descendants of Anak there." Those are giants. The Amalekites live in the Negev. The Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites live in the hill country. Canaanites live near the sea along the Jordan." Then Caleb silenced them and said, "We should go up and take possession of the land, for we can do it." The men who'd gone up with him said, "We can't attack those people. They're stronger than we are." They spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they had explored. They said, "The land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there of great size, the Nephilim," there again are the giants. "We seem like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we look the same to them." And that night all the people of the community raised their voices, wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole assembly said to them, "If only we'd died in Egypt or in this desert," and so on and so on. And they're complaining, and they're going to stone Joshua and Caleb for the good report, and they make the decision to go back. And they start wandering around for 40 years. And the 10 spies bought a report to say there's no way. Now, what they failed to see was God's sovereignty. They only saw the giants. The failure of the church across America today is the failure to see the sovereignty of God. We must restore that concept scripturally once again so that we are set free to trust Him and not be defeated by giants. He is above them and beyond them. And in spite of the failure of these people, God got His people in there anyway. So the Israelites go wandering in the wilderness. They run out of food and they complain. God said, "You haven't learned a lesson? Take another lap." They want meat. They complain. God says, "Take another lap. You haven't learned yet." Complain about no water. "You haven't learned yet. Take another lap." Clothing, shoes. Deuteronomy says that God provided their clothing. Their shoes didn't wear out. He took care of them. He guided them. But they complained. And as they complained, they needed to learn to trust. He says, "Take another lap." Do you ever have a coach tell you that? "Take another lap, buddy. You haven't learned yet." We're such slow learners. Some of us are taking laps. But God will get us there anyway. Now, this is the message of the book. God did it anyway. And He got the people into the promised land. And next week when we study Joshua, that's what we'll be considering, how God did it, how He put them there, and the experience of that. God will put His people in the land. Now, from a doctrinal viewpoint, what are we thinking about? We're thinking about the fact that God is in control of our justification. He makes us right with Himself. And what we're failing to see today is that God is in control of our sanctification, bringing us along in the Christian life to make us holy and to live righteously. That's what He's doing. That's why you're here this morning as a Christian. That's why you are on earth this morning as a Christian. When God regenerated you and brought you into His family, you are a citizen of heaven. But He left you here. And that sanctification process is taking place. And God is in control of that. And we are as the Israelites. We sin and we fail. And we do that miserably. But God is going to take us through and into the land of heaven with Himself. He's in control. He's not defeated by our failure and our unbelief. This can be a wilderness for us. This present state has a conflict of logistics and food and water and pressure and turmoil and trial and distress and fear and hatred and depression. And there are giants here. Fortified strongholds where evil is entrenched. But the weapons of our warfare are mighty through God. And God will bring us through and into. He will. Every one of His elect people are going to make it. And the message of this book is encouragement. Take heart, Christian friend. God will bring us through and into the land. He will. That's His commitment. That's encouragement. If you feel like you're flopping around in the Christian life this morning, read the book of Numbers and see the faithfulness of God. and how he brings his people through and into. Now, this is encouraging. Discouragement is one of the worst things we face in this life. Discouragement robs us. We all need encouragement. There is not a person in this room this morning that does not need encouragement. And the encouragement comes from the Word of God to see His commitment to us to bring us through and into. Now, discouragement robs us of a lot of things. A person who is discouraged does not serve the Lord. He's just robbed of strength and energy and motivation and inspiration. It's wonderful when you're encouraged. It's inspiring, it's motivating, and it's powerful in our lives. And the thing we need from the Word of God is encouragement to see His sovereign power, His ability to bring us through these trials, through this land, and into heaven with Himself. He's committed to do that. Need to learn to trust Him today. To trust in the Lord with all our heart and lean not to our own reasoning, but in all our ways acknowledge Him. Know that He will direct our path. What a great lesson from the book of Numbers. The faithfulness of God. He did it anyway. In spite of me, He does it. Not because of us, but in spite of us, God gets His work done. And we have the privilege of being among those who live on this earth who will honor Him by trusting Him. Now we are all at different levels in the process of our sanctification. And we all carry a burden of some kind this morning. And we often think, well, what great activity is there that I could enter into that would solve everything? What could I do for God that would show I'm a great servant? We get to thinking that way. The one thing you and I can do this morning that will honor Him the most and will bring great glory to Him is simply to trust Him. If in the moments that we close our service in singing prayer, if you could be saying in your heart, Lord, I'm up against it. It's tough where I am, but I will bow here before You this morning and trust You. I will trust You. Now, we don't give invitations here. We don't ask you to raise your hand or stand up or come forward, but that does not mean we are not responsible to respond to the Word of God. And we cannot ignore the message of the book of Numbers. Don't turn it off. Keep your thoughts right here as we sing and respond. And all day long, don't turn it off. Keep thinking about this. And receive encouragement because God will do it anyway.